Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Tonight we're in the book of Ruth, so go there. There's a likelihood that we'll just finish the book of Ruth tonight, because chapter 3 is a short chapter, and content-wise, it's just informing us about how it is that Boaz and Ruth get to know each other, and Ruth has the opportunity to explain to Boaz that he is the near kinsman, that he is the Goel, the Redeemer. And so chapter 3 we'll get through very quickly, so we really have two options. We could make it a 15 to 20 minute evening and then just all go home and call that chapter 3, or we could go on to chapter 4 and probably finish the book tonight. So I'm going to go ahead and just keep talking and hopefully finish the book tonight, and then if you all have anywhere to be, just roll out of here. It was a wheelchair joke. So let's pray, and we'll look into the Word. Heavenly Father, thank you for this evening. And as we open your Word tonight, I pray that you will guard our hearts and our minds, open our understanding, open our eyes, make us attentive to your Word, cause us to listen, and not only to listen, but to truly hear. And as we leave here tonight, I pray that we will have a greater understanding of who you are and what you're like, and that we will see in this story of Ruth the foreshadows of your Son who came to be our Goel, our Redeemer. And we thank you for the way that you have orchestrated the events of human history in such a way that you have been preaching and teaching for many thousands of years the same gospel, good news story of our redemption through your Son. And we thank you for all this in Christ Jesus' name. Amen. Chapter 3, verse 1. Then Naomi, Ruth's mother-in-law, said to her daughter, "Shall I not seek security for you? Then it may be well with you." That seems to be an implication of, "Shall I not find you a husband? After all, you were married to my son, and he died." And women, as you know, in that time and in that culture, if they were not married, had very little means of support, so very little security in their life. And there they were, two single women, both widows. And so she was saying, "Shouldn't I seek out some form of security for you? And now is not Boaz our kinsman with whose maids you were? Behold, he winnows barley in the threshing floor tonight." You know what winnowing barley is? That's an interesting phrase. Throw it up in the air. That's exactly right. You would take the husk that you'd taken off the plant, and it had the corn inside the husk, and then they would get out onto the threshing floor and they would beat it. And as they beat the husk and the husk would separate, they would then take all of it, throw it in the air, and they would usually do it in the evenings when it was windy, and they would do it outside the city on the plains. That's where the threshing floors were, because that's where the wind would whip up. And then the lighter husk would blow away and the heavier kernel would fall to the ground, and that way they could separate the wheat from the chaff. And by the way, there is a Latin term for doing that exact thing, for beating the husk in order to separate the good food from the husk. And the Latin term is tribulum. And that word has moved into our English language as tribulation, which is that beating that causes separation, that separates the good from the husk. And so you can see why why that is a good use of a word to describe not only what we're seeing here in the book of Ruth, but also what's going to happen at the end of time, that God is going to do the separating, and he's going to do it through the means of tribulum, through the winnowing, through the separating. So she gives her this advice, verse 3, "Wash yourself, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your best clothes." In other words, doll yourself up. Wash yourself. You don't see doll yourself up. You don't see that exactly. Yeah, wash yourself. such as smell of nice, and then anoint yourself. Now, of course, these were poor women. They're probably not going to have expensive perfumes or any of the aromatic spices. But at very least, it means have some oil to put on your skin to make yourself look smooth and attractive. Put on your good clothes. Go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. And it shall be when he lays down that you shall notice the place where he lays, and then you will go and uncover his feet and lay down, and then he will tell you what you should do. Now, there's a bit of controversy about that whole passage. There are some commentaries you can read that say that she was trying to entice the man. Wait till he's eaten, wait till he's drunk, wait till he's laying down, and then go in your prettiest version and lay down next to him, and whatever he says, participate. And then when he wakes up and sees that he has done that according to the law reaching all the way back into Exodus, then he would have to marry her, because the rule is, if you took a woman, now that particular rule was if you took a virgin and if you forced yourself on her, that you had to pay the price of her virginity, you had to pay a fee for it, and you had to take her to wife. And so there's one line of reasoning and thought that says that's what's happening here, that Naomi in her desperation recognizes that Ruth is pretty and that the best shot at getting Boaz to redeem her would be to trick him into it. So wait till he's drunk, go to him at night, lay down next to him, whatever he says, participate in it, and then you have a really good likelihood of ending up married to him. And then, of course, there's the other school of thought that wants to protect the reputation of Boaz and Ruth and Naomi. And they say that, in fact, all she was doing was going there at night to lay down next to him so that when he woke up and saw her there, she would be at his feet in an innocent position, and that she would then say, I'm here as a servant to you because you are my kinsman, and by laying here at your feet, I'm making myself available to be your wife. So those are the two different schools of thought. I'm not really going to choose sides. I think there are legitimate arguments for either reading. But in either case, I think the go at night, lay down next to him after he's drunk thing is a little sketchy, but nevertheless, that's the plan. So she said to her, all that you have said, I will do. So she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law had commanded her. Now, by the way, you'll notice that one of the things she said was, don't make yourself known to the man. In order to make herself known to the man or even to any of the servants, maybe that has to do with they've only seen her in the fields, in the heat of the day, like one of the many impoverished people gleaning in the field, and that maybe he wouldn't have recognized her now, dressed up, cleaned up, the oils on her body looking provocative. But certainly, she didn't want to show up there looking like that when there were lots of men around. So the advice, wait until he has eaten and drunk and then watch where he goes and then follow him, that's probably safe advice in the night outside the city, out in the fields. And of course, we saw last week how Boaz had taken particular care and concern to protect her from the men in the fields. Verse 6 says, so she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lay down at the end of the heap of grain. And she came secretly, uncovered his feet, and laid down. We don't really know what that phrase, uncovered his feet, means. As many commentaries as you read, you'll find that many different explanations of what the significance is of uncovering his feet. But what they all seem to agree about is that when they went out to sleep in the fields, it would get chilly at night. These are people who often wore sandals or walked barefoot. And I don't know about you, but if I go to sleep, even without a blanket on a warm night, I still have to put something over my feet. My feet get cold. I'm a cold-footed human. Cold feet is not uncommon at night, and so he would have used part of his robe, or he would have used some kind of a blanket or a coat, something to cover his feet as he slept. And so the instruction is go uncover his feet, lay at his feet, perhaps even becoming the warmth for his feet, or take his blanket and put it over yourself, and then you're warming yourself and his feet. But in some way, it demonstrates her servitude that she did not go lay down next to him as if they were already married, but lay down at his feet where a servant would be. So it is an act of humility. And it happened in the middle of the night that the man was startled, probably because his feet were cold. That's my guess. He probably woke up and went, "My feet are freezing." So the man was startled and he bent forward. In other words, he sat up and behold, a woman was lying at his feet. And he said, "Who are you?" Of course, it's dark. And she answered, "I'm Ruth, your maid. So spread your covering over your maid, for you are a close relative." This is the NASB reading, "Put your covering over me." The actual Hebrew word is wing. Some of your translations will say, "Spread your wings over me." Yes. It's a protective movement, the way that a mother bird would spread her wings over her chicks. And so she is saying, "Protect me. I am your maid, and I am available to be married, and I need your covering. I need your protection, for you are a close relative. You are my Goel. You are my Redeemer." Then he said, "May you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter." Now, I have to admit, I really like this phrase, because this shows you that he was an older gentleman, and that she, being a much younger, prettier woman, he's really taken aback by all of this, because we men, especially we older men, we like attention. Yes, Tom? Yeah, Tom.
Don't know what you're talking about.
Yes, we like attention from women. And so he's surprised. He says this, "May you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter. You have shown your last kindness to be better than the first." In other words, you were kind to begin with, and now you're even more kind by not going after young men, whether poor or rich. In other words, I know I got a little bit of money, and I know I'm your Redeemer, but look at you. You could have had your pick of the litter, and you're coming to me? You're young, you're attractive, you could have gotten a young man, whether a poor man or a rich man. You had options, and yet you're interested in me. So, like any man, he enjoyed the attention, and he appreciates the attention. "And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you whatever you ask, for all my people in the city know that you are a woman of excellence." So you are a virtuous woman, and everybody knows that. So that means that he feels good about the prospect of marrying her, knowing that it's not going to be any sort of blight against his own reputation as a dignified man of means in the community. But then he tells her in verse 12, "Now it is true, I am a close relative. However, there is a relative closer than I." I was reading today that one of the early accountings of this family group among the Jewish rabbis say that Boaz and Elimelech were probably cousins, but that this nearer kinsman would have been Elimelech's uncle, making him a nearer kinsman than a cousin. And so he says there is a relative of your husband's who is closer than I, or of your father-in-law, closer than I. "Remain this night, and when morning comes, if he will redeem you, then good, let him redeem you. But if he does not wish to redeem you, then I will redeem you. As the Lord lives, lie down until morning." So she laid at his feet until morning, and rose before one could recognize another. In other words, she got up early while it was still dark. And he said, "Let it not be known that a woman came to the threshing floor." And again he said, "Give me the cloak that is on you, and then hold it." In other words, take your coat out and use it like a basket. Hold it out. And she held it, and he measured 6 measures of barley and laid it on her, and she went into the city. By the way, I just like the phrase in the NASB that he laid it on her and laid it on the coat, but I like to read it, "He took the 6 measures of barley and laid it on her." It's just a better reading.
He tied it on her where it wouldn't spill.
Exactly. Tied it around her in such a way that she could carry it. But I like my reading anyway.
That was real nice.
was octogenarian sarcasm. That's what that was. She went, yeah, that's real nice. Mm-hmm. Verse 16, and when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, how did it go, my daughter? And she told her all that the man had done for her. And she said, these 6 measures of barley he gave me, for he said, do not go to your mother-in-law empty-handed. Then she said, wait, my daughter, until you know how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest until he has settled it today. In other words, Naomi seems to have figured out that if he's being this kind to you and giving you all this barley, he's clearly interested in you, so he's not going to wait. He's going to go settle it. He's going to go find the nearer kinsman, and he's going to work it out today. So you just wait. Here's a man with some anxiousness to him. Now, that's the end of chapter 3. So that would be our 20-minute evening, or we can continue into chapter 4. How are we feeling?
Move on.
Now, Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there. By the way, the gate is where the business was typically done, in the gate of the city. That's where the men of the city would gather, and that's where they would tell the latest stories and bring the latest news and conduct their affairs of business. And so he went to the gate. Settle their judgments, absolutely. And behold, the close relative of whom Boaz spoke was passing by. So he said, turn aside, friend. Sit down here. And he turned aside, and he sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said to them, sit down here. So they sat down. They're going to become the witnesses. They're going to become the jury as he decides this situation that has to do with rightful ownership of the land that belongs to Elimelech. And so in this redemption process, he's going to have 10 witnesses who agree that either this man is going to do the redemption or Boaz is going to do the redemption. But either way, the issue is going to be settled right here and now, and you men are the judges here.
You have to have a minion for that, huh?
You have to have a minion?
A minion, that's 10 men.
Is that 10 men, a minion? Well, there you go. I learned something. Then he said to the closest relative, Naomi, who has come back from the land of Moab, has to sell a piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. So I thought to inform you, saying, buy it before those who are sitting here and before the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. And if not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am after you. And he said, I will redeem it. And I have to assume that at that moment, Boaz's heart sunk a little. Because he was looking forward not only to redeeming the land, but he had an eye out for Ruth. So then he says, on the day that you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also acquire Ruth, the Moabitess, the widow of the deceased, in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance. Now, we talked about this when we were doing the introduction to the book of Ruth, that what is really going on here is that any child that she has through a redeemer, through a Goel, becomes the descendant of the family of Elimelech. And as you know, every 50 years on the year of Jubilee, all the land, regardless of who has bought it or what purchases have been made with it, the land reverts back to its original owners. And so, if the land were to revert back to a descendant of Elimelech, then once this man, the closest relative, has redeemed it, he's going to take some of his own money, which would have been part of his posterity and the inheritance that goes to his children. He would take some portion of that, use it to redeem this other piece of land, but that piece of land would not go to his posterity. Elimelech's land would go to any descendant that he had with Ruth.
It's going to go to Obed.
Well, it's ultimately going to go to Obed.
Yeah.
This we know. But he didn't know that yet.
What about Chilion?
Apparently there weren't any children there.
Obed.
And remember, his wife went
so
back.
He got it. So Obed got it all.
Yeah, got it all at that point. Exactly.
Okay.
So I'll tell you what. Let's, while we're stopped here, keep your finger there. And turn backwards for a moment to the book of Deuteronomy. Go to Deuteronomy 25. because there's a very interesting rule in Deuteronomy 25. And I enjoy saying the word Deuteronomy, and I managed to slip it in one more time. Deuteronomy 25, starting in verse 5. When brothers live together, and one of them dies, and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a strange man. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her to himself as wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And it shall be that the firstborn whom she bears shall assume the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out from Israel. So there's the rule. The firstborn child that Ruth has is going to be the descendant of her actual husband and then get Elimelech's land and inheritance. But, says verse 7, but if the man does not desire to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to establish the name for his brother in Israel. He is not willing to perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Then the elders of the city shall summon him and speak to him. And if he persists and says, I do not desire to take her, then his brother's wife shall come to him in the sight of the elders and pull his sandal off his foot and spit in his face. And she shall declare, thus it is done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. And in Israel, his name shall be called the house of him whose sandal is removed. And you put that right on the mailbox. This is the house of him whose sandal has been removed. Now that rule and the removal of the sandal will help us understand what takes place next in the book of Ruth. So now I'll go back to Ruth. Because Boaz has just said in verse 5, on the day that you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also acquire Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of the deceased, in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance. And the closest relative said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I jeopardize my own inheritance. Now again, some of the earliest Jewish commentaries on this say that he had a family, he was a married man with some children, and that being the case, now he's looking at introducing another wife into the mix, and he's going to be taking, like I said, some of the money that would be the inheritance of the children he has with his current wife, and using that inheritance that would have belonged to them to buy the field and the land that Elimelech owned, but then it would not go to them. It wouldn't be part of their posterity. So they're actually losing a piece of their own inheritance in this process. And so he says, I can't redeem it for myself unless I jeopardize my own inheritance. So redeem it for yourself, and you may have my right of redemption, for I cannot redeem it. Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning the redemption and the exchange of land to confirm any matter. A man removed his sandal and gave it to another. And this was the manner of attestation in Israel. Why? Because of what we just read in Deuteronomy. So he took his sandal off and gave it to him, and this became, instead of it being what we read in Deuteronomy, the woman taking his sandal and spitting in his face, this became a form of right of refusal, so that when Boaz went to lay claim to Elimelech's land, he was able to say, and I have the sandal of the first closest relative, and he has given up his right to the land, and here is the sandal that attests to that fact, so I have the right to redeem this land.
And the 10 men who were sitting there as witnesses saw it.
And that's the next thing. He's going to say, and you are witnesses to this exchange. So the closest relative said, buy it for yourself, and he removed his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and to all the people, you are witnesses today that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon. Moreover, I have acquired Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, to be my wife in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance, so that the name of the deceased may not be cut off from his brothers or from the court of his birthplace, and you are witnesses today." So all the people who were in the court and the elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, both of whom built the house of Israel, and may you achieve wealth in Ephratah and become famous in Bethlehem." So now they're pronouncing a blessing on his marriage and on the new woman, and they reach back to two of the women that everyone in Israel held in high esteem, the sisters Rachel and Leah, because between the two of them came all 12 tribes of Israel. But then they didn't stop there. After all, these are descendants of Judah, and they are the particular descendants of Judah who ended up in the area of Bethlehem. So they move from that to, may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. Now that's just really, really interesting, by the way. You know the story. The story is very, very similar. Tamar was married to one of the sons of Judah, and when her husband died and she was childless, the next son in line, Onan, refused to finish the process, and so she wasn't impregnated by him. And Judah promised that when his youngest was old enough, that she would get him. Now, Tamar was also a foreign woman, just like Ruth is a foreign woman. And Tamar had a son of Judah that died, and Ruth had a son of Judah that died. Now, unfortunately, the way that Tamar finally got pregnant was that she went out and dressed herself up like a prostitute, and Judah came by, saw her, and went in unto her, good Bible language, not knowing that was his daughter-in-law, and she became pregnant from that. God just entering into that process to continue the family line of Judah, because after all, it had already been prophesied that through Judah was going to come the Messiah, so that family line can't stop. And then, of course, when Judah heard that his daughter-in-law was pregnant, he became all indignant about it and threatened to have her done away with. And so she came in front of him, and she had been wise enough that when they had cohabitated, she took a couple tokens from him. Yeah. And so when he was busy condemning her, she said, "Well, I'm pregnant by the man who owns this." Pulled out the tokens, and then he realized that he was actually the father of these children, and the children turned out to be twins. Now, of the two twins, one of them, Perez, is the progenitor through which Bethlehem is established. And so all of these Judahites living in Bethlehem, five family groups, five family lineages, are descendants of Perez, descendants of Judah, descendants of Rachel and Leah. Actually, Leah. And so not only do they say, "We hope that your wife is going to be like Rachel and Leah," but they take the time to narrow it down and say, "May your house be like the house of Perez, who is one of the sons of Tamar." And Tamar bore Perez from Judah himself. And of course, she was a foreign woman who hadn't had any children. So the parallels are really dramatic here. And they pull those parallels out, recognizing that she's a foreign woman without any children.
And they're telling Ruth, "You're not the first.
You're not the first one to join this family group from a foreign nation." And certainly God has used those women in order to continue the family line that, like I said, leads ultimately to Christ, as we're going to see at the end of this book. "So moreover, may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, through the offspring which the Lord shall give you by this young woman." By the way, that blessing did take hold, because like I said, this is the family line that leads directly to David, and then through David to Christ. "So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And he went into her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son." I won't spend a whole lot of time stumping about this tonight, but I am impressed once again by how often when babies are conceived in the Bible, God gets all the credit. That the Lord yet again enabled her to conceive. This was not just Mother Nature at work. And this was not Darwinism doing its thing. This was the Lord enabling her to conceive. And that really needs to inform our thinking when we think about some of our more contemporary cultural questions about things like abortion. If in fact God enables women to conceive and then human beings decide to abort that child, they really are saying that they know better than God in that instance, and that human will, human decision making is superior to God's decision making. So, like I said, I am yet again impressed by the reality of how frequently the Bible draws a direct line from the womb to God's will. So she was enabled to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. Then the women said to Naomi, now remember in the beginning of this book, when she first got to town, she said, don't call me Naomi. That's a happy name. That's a cheerful name. Don't call me that. Call me Mara, because the Lord has dealt with me bitterly. And she went through years of loss and bitterness, and lost not only her husband, but also her children, and in the process, lost her inheritance, lost the land, lost the covering of a man, lost a tremendous amount, and so she considered herself to be bitter and wanted to be referred to that way. But now the women are saying to her, blessed is the Lord who has not left you without a redeemer today. So on the day of the wedding, on the day of the marriage, and then finally a child, all the women are celebrating with her because God has taken this terrible circumstance and turned it around so completely that not only is the land redeemed, but the family is redeemed, the inheritance is redeemed, and now she has a grandson, and the name of Elimelech is going to continue, and you will notice yet again who they gave credit for that. The constant awareness was, this is the work of the Lord. And blessed is the Lord who has not left you without a redeemer today, and may his name become famous in Israel. May he also be to you a restorer of life and a sustainer in your old age, for your daughter-in-law, who loves you and is better to you than seven sons, has given birth to him. Then Naomi took the child and laid him in her lap and became his nurse. And the neighbor women gave him the name, saying, a son has been born to Naomi, and they called him Obed. Do you know what Obed means, by the way? It means servant, to serve. And so he becomes, in so many ways, a servant of the Lord. And there's a little play on words there, because this all happened because Ruth laid at Boaz's feet like a servant. And so all of this is in the service of God, and God brings all these apparently random events together in such a way that it weaves together this great story of redemption and of the concept of a near kinsman. And the book of Ruth is in the Old Testament not only to clean up what we saw at the end of the Judges and all the bad stuff that happened in Bethlehem. I am convinced that it's Samuel that wrote this, because in a moment he's going to give us a genealogy that could only have been written after the fact. And it was probably written during the time of King David's reign. And so the story of Ruth is there to show the family lineage and the character of the people who led to the king. And so it's really a bit of character building and storytelling in order to establish that King David is a good man who comes from good stock of good people. And even though they would read in the Judges about the bad stuff that happened in Bethlehem, they could then say, yes, but look at this good thing that happened at Bethlehem. There were good people, good stock, good families there as well. And that's David's lineage, his stock. So they named him Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. That's what they want you to know. That's the point of the story. So the point of the story is to draw the line to King David and say, this is the stock, these are the people who produced our king. But at the same time, it is the introduction in the Old Testament of the concept of kinsman redeemer. And since we know that Christ comes directly from the lineage of David, this establishes that part of the genealogy that we find in Matthew and in Luke that draws the connection from David to Jesus. And so, kinsman redeemer. Let's just talk about that briefly, and then we'll be done for the evening. Verse 18 says, these are the generations of Perez. Perez, to Perez was born Hezron, and to Hezron was born Ram, and to Ram, Amminadab, And to Aminadab was born Nashon, and to Nashon Salmon, and to Salmon was born Boaz, and to Boaz Obed, and to Obed was born Jesse, and to Jesse was born David. So there's the direct link from Judah through Perez to David. This is David's pedigree, that he is not just a Judahite, but he can trace his lineage directly to Judah the father, and that establishes him yet again as king of Israel. Now, the whole story, as I said, establishes the concept of kinsman redeemer. Last week I tried to stress that there were two requirements in order to be, well, there were three requirements in order to be, there were four requirements, no, there's really three, I'll stop at three. There were three requirements in order to be a goel. Do you remember what they were? You had to be near of kin. Couldn't be a stranger. That was the first thing. You had to actually be family. And that is why the New Testament spends so much time stressing family relationship between Christ and those that he came to redeem. That's why the language of adoption is so important, that we Gentiles who are not his flesh and blood family are adopted into the family so that he continues to be our near kin. Such near kin, in fact, that he's called our brother, our older brother, and that he is not ashamed to call us brethren. So it's not second cousin once removed. Christ is not our kin from a distant family who was, you know, who was the next door neighbor of somebody your mother knew. He is your brother, and you don't get closer than that. To be brother and brother is to be born of the same mother and the same father. And so the language of the New Testament, when it stresses this brotherhood, this unity between Christ and his people, it's doing that on purpose because it's establishing that he has the right, as our nearest of kin, to do the redemptive work. Secondly, remember what the second rule was? You had to be able to pay. You had to actually have the money. You could be the nearest kin and not have the redemption price, and you were disqualified because you couldn't do it. You couldn't do the redemption work. You couldn't pay whatever was owed. And so in order to be the near kinsman, you had to be the nearest of the kin, and then you had to have the actual price that was required to pay the redemption and ransom the land back from whatever debt it was under. And then the third thing was, you had to be willing to do it. And you'll notice that the nearest kin wasn't willing, and Boaz was willing. And that's what made him the actual goel. Even though there was a nearest kinsman, he wasn't the redeemer because he wasn't willing. He had the price, and he was the nearest kin, but he wasn't willing to do it. And so Boaz becomes the actual redeemer because he was the closest relative who also had the money, who was also willing. And so in the New Testament, we're told that Christ not only was our near kinsman, but that he had the price that nobody else had. The problem we had was that we simply could not pay the price that was owed, the debt that we owed God, for our sin, for our depravity, for the way we are, for our humanity, for our wretchedness, for our fleshliness. We are sinning, have sinned, did sin, will sin, continue to sin against an eternally holy God. Therefore, the only price that can be paid to him has to be some eternal price sufficient to pay an eternal offense against an eternal God. And I just don't have that in my wallet. And neither do any of you. None of us have the capacity to pay God for the kind of debt we owe.
But he did buy back the land.
Well, we'll get to that. Hold on. Hold on. Christ not only was our near kinsman, but he had the price.
And he was willing.
And he was willing to pay that price. And that price was the blood of God that flowed through his veins. And he was willing to spill his blood and take our punishment and suffer the wrath of God and be humiliated after having lived a perfect life before the law as our substitute. So he was willing to do all that. He was willing to pay the price. He was willing to be our near kinsman. He was willing to be our substitute. He was willing to be our redeemer. And he paid the ultimate price, which was that, as I said on Sunday, his visage was marred more than any man. He was tortured for 3 hours by God pouring out wrath on him that none of us can begin to comprehend or will ever have to experience.
There was no restraint on the brutality that was poured out on him.
There was no restraint on the brutality, exactly, by men and by God. And he did it willingly, even though he understood how terrible it was going to be, as the Gethsemane experience shows us. He knew how bad it was going to be and did say things like, if it were possible, take this cup from me. But what am I going to say? I came here for this hour. This is what I came for. And so he does lay his life down willingly. He does say things like, no man takes my life from me. I have the power to lay my life down. I have the power to take it up again. And I have this command from my Father. So he made it very clear that what he did willingly, and he did on purpose, and he did it in order to redeem his people. And the redemption which he proffered was a complete redemption. That's why on the cross he would say, Tetelestai, it is finished, because the work that he came to do, which was to save his people, was fully accomplished when his blood flowed and when he had borne the wrath of God on our behalf. So it was a complete redemption. Which is why then the other New Testament writers, particularly Paul, whenever they talk about the redemptive work of Christ, talk about it as a finished work. It's a done deal. We have been, past tense, fully redeemed. So even though we are here on the planet looking forward to the day of our full and complete physical redemption and our gathering to Him in the heavenlies, nevertheless, we are right now already His possession, because we have been redeemed and He already owns us. And all of that is prefigured back here in the rule that we heard in Deuteronomy, in the rules that there are in Exodus about keeping the posterity going, and then in the book of Ruth and the concept of the Goel and the Redeemer. All of that is just God writing the gospel in human history and weaving that thread, guiding us right toward Christ. And he couldn't have made it any more obvious when he made sure that the family line and lineage that it happened in was the lineage of Judah through David to Christ. So God is being very exacting in explaining this theological concept in the experiences of human life in the Old Testament, and then it becomes a theological reality in the New Testament. But it's all saying the same thing, which is it's finished. Which is, we've been redeemed. Which is, he died and we live. Which is, our Goel, our brother, our near kinsman, paid the price because he was willing to. Therefore, there's no more price for us to pay. The price has been paid, the redemption work has been done, and that's why we can say with great boldness that we are indeed saved.
Didn't cost Ruth anything.
Mm-mm. Didn't cost Ruth anything. Yes, sir.
I think that through all this you can see this strong desire to invent a spiritual Israel as to put us, you know, right in that family. Okay. Well, the trouble is, it doesn't work.
It doesn't work. And there's no need to. There's no real necessity if you just let the Bible speak.
Exactly.
Yeah. But as Gladys was getting at a few moments ago, I didn't use the word interrupt. But as she was saying, the redemptive work of Christ also established the validity and perpetuity of the Abrahamic covenant. And so Christ also did redeem the land that is part of the redemption price that he paid, and all those promises then through Abraham to Israel about their establishment as a nation, all 12 tribes, the consistent testimony of all the Old Testament prophets concerning a future regathering of Israel back in the land of Canaan, all of that is established as well. It's just that now, instead of it being established through the Mosaic law, which is done away with, it's established in the new covenant, which was promised all the way back in Jeremiah 31. And so the redemptive work of Christ is much larger and much more sweeping and dramatic than simply he saved me. And I don't mean to say simply he saved me, because he saved me is a really big deal to me. I like that he saved me. I'm a great fan of that concept. However, if I limit my thinking about Christ's salvific work to merely what he did for me, I am missing the grand scope of the plan of God in human history, which is that his son was, after all, the savior of Israel, and that he is the redeemer of Israel, and that he is establishing all of the promises of God to God's elect people. And so, as Gladys said, he is also ultimately redeeming the land that goes with the people he's redeeming, because it is a full and a complete redemption. And the Bible is consistent with itself, and as Conrad said, there's no necessity to start spiritualizing that stuff to eliminate Israel from their own promises. Right?
Right.
Right. Good.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.